Oh my goodness. Well, let's begin here. And there's so much to talk about, so much going on with you. You are a very busy man these days. I did not know it, and I just happened upon it by accident, and there you were on the latest episode of Hacks.
That is amazing, because we actually shot that like a couple years ago.
Wow.
I want to say, like, after the pandemic began, because I know the pandemic was happening, and we shot that in some mansion up where all the fancy mansions are, not even in Beverly Hills, but in places that are even fancier than Beverly Hills. And one thing that does not translate on the TV screen is that the production rents the mansion, and the people who live in the mansion still kind of hang around to make sure you don't do any damage, because they'll sue you. But also, production is involved. They are responsible for paying for the bills during the period of time that you're shooting.
Oh.
So they did not want to pay for heating. They did not want to pay for it to be heating. And outside, it was, I mean, we were getting close to the 30s. It was 40 degrees. So we were freezing. We were freezing inside there, and they would not turn on the heat. So in the mansion scenes with Gene, where we're playing cards, whatever that card game was we were playing, it was freezing cold. And it was the first time in my history as an actor. You always have continuity people as when you're doing a scene, because you never shoot the scene in order, and you have to know like what level your drink is at when you say a certain line. Well, we were playing cards, and so we had a card continuity expert that they were watching the game, and they go, okay, Stephen, now you played the seven of spades. Now you played the ace of clubs was next. And the next card you're going to draw a card. It's going to be the five of clubs. You're going to hold that and try to make a book out of it. You know, and I'm going like zip in one ear. You lost me there. But it was Gene Smart and I don't know if people know this. We go way back. And I want to say we go back to 1981.
Wow.
At the Hartford Stage Company, she was doing a play there that was on stage, and I was doing a play that was rehearsing and about to go on stage. And so always when we finished rehearsal and when Gene finished a show, we would go out and have drinks up at the bar, which was called The Asylum.
Because
unfortunately, the theater and on the top of the hill, that street in front of the theater was called Asylum, why they would name it that. And it is at the famous Asylum Bar during this time where Gene and I were going out getting drinks that I was almost murdered twice in 1 week. So almost murdered twice at the Asylum. Now, I'm not exaggerating. I'm not using the M word to be dramatic, but it was like on a Tuesday and a Thursday. So there was a Wednesday in between. But on the Tuesday, my girlfriend, Beth Henley, who had written the play that we were doing at Hartford Stage Company, The Wake of Jamie Foster, we went up to have a drink with Gene and their cast. They were doing a play, I believe it was called Keen, about Edmund Keen, or the and God, Gene was fantastic. She's just a star in that show. And so I loved pinball at the time. And so I was playing a pinball game up at the Asylum Bar, drinking a beer, and you put the beer on the pinball machine, and I'm playing away. And Beth comes up to me and says, sweetie, help get this guy off of me. And I said, well, I will in a second, sweetie, but I really got a free ball coming. Let me see if I can get a few more points here. And I'm doing this, and I look over, and she was not exaggerating. There was a man that was on top of her, like grabbing her, and she was struggling against this person, this man. And so I let the pinball machine go. And in the most manly way I could, I walk up, I get this guy, and I said, "That's my girl. Get your hands off of her." And I took him and I pushed him. And I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3", and I guess I had a little adrenaline because I got the free ball. I had a little adrenaline, and he flew backwards against the wall, and now he's coming after me. And he starts using all the bad words that begin with M and F and all these words like this, and he starts coming to attack. And I run, and Beth is now nowhere to be seen, so I run to find Beth, and she's at her table drinking wine. And I said, "Baby, we got to get out of here. This guy over here is trying to kill me." And she says, "Well, let me finish my drink first." I said, "No, baby, not now. Now we have to run. We have to run." So we ran out the front door of the asylum, ran around to the back door. This guy runs out, and now he's pulling out a gun.
Whoa.
So, yes, he's pulling out a gun, a little gun like this. And he's yelling, "Come on." And he's using bad language. You know, people with guns, a lot of times they use bad language. And he says, "You know, come on, come on." And I'm running around, and I go, and I hear him yelling, coming around the side of the bar. So Beth and I run back around to the front of the bar, and I said, "Let's go home. You'll finish your drink later. And we walked back home. That was on a Tuesday. On a Thursday, that same week, I'm going to the asylum bar, and there was a group of people coming in to the bar, and I decided to open the door, for it was a man and two women. I opened the door for them, but the way the door opened, it was that my hand kind of went across the opening, even though I said, "Please, come on in." And he thought I was blocking the way for him and the two women. And he says, again, he uses very bad language. He called me something like a mofo. And then he pulled out a knife and he stabbed me.
Oh, my God.
He said, "You trying to block me and my ladies from coming into the, from coming?" I said, "No, I'm not." And then he stabs me, but it's so cold in Hartford. Now, you want to talk about luck. It's so cold in Hartford. I'm wearing my overcoat with kind of a belted overcoat, and the knife goes into the belt of the overcoat, and it doesn't stick me. It gets stuck there, but he thinks he stabbed me in the stomach, and he walks in with the ladies, and I say once again to Beth, "Let's walk home before these people kill us."
That's a week.
That's a week. So be careful in Hartford, Connecticut. Be careful going to the asylum bar. But that's where I met Gene Smart.
Wow.
And that's where we used to hang out together. And doing hacks was just cold but wonderful. Working with Gene again, it was just fantastic. And I worked on designing women with her. So we had worked together. But why it was put off for a couple years, that we shot it, and now they just released it. I had thought all of this time, because I looked on IMDb, I said, "Well, I've done hacks. What? Oh, they cut me out of the show." I thought they just cut me out, and that it was playing, and you know, I just wasn't there anymore. But no, they held up production for a while. So I guess they took a year off. They took like a hiatus, and it's such a delightful show. It's such a funny show. If you people don't know Hacks, it is a blast to watch. It's wonderful, and you will love Gene Smart the way we all love Gene Smart.
She's great, and we've had Lorraine Newman on the show, daughter Hannah is so brilliant.
Hannah is fantastic. It's a great cast. It's a great show, and I'm happy that it happened. I'm so happy.
Last time you were on, you told us a little bit about the new movie you were in, and now it is out, Pool Man, directed by Chris Pine. I've seen the only review that counts, which is Anne's, and she absolutely loved it.
Yes, Anne loved it, and there are people that absolutely love it, and there are people that don't love it. And the thing about this movie, when I read the script, I loved it. I thought it was absolutely nutty and hysterical. And I believe I mentioned last time that the character that they wanted me to play was Stephen Tarankowski was the name of the character. I'm saying, oh, come on, give me a break. Just offer me the part. But we had this, Chris and I, we had this discussion about the movie and the part I play in it. And it's just wacky, wacky humor. And when Annie and I first saw the movie, it was at Chris's agency. We watched it with cast and crew there. And as soon as the movie ended, we looked at each other and said, I want to see it again right now. So it is the kind of movie that inspires immediate enthusiasm or people going like, what did I just watch? And for me, I found it delightful, strange, and hilarious. But what I told Annie, and I still stick to my guns on this, and I tell Chris this too, I think it's kind of like a Rocky Horror Picture Show. It's like a midnight movie. It's like something that, you know, you get some friends and you go there at, you know, 11 o'clock at night, 11:30 at night, and watch this thing because it's not like Gone with the Wind. And it's every scene is just wacky doodle. And it's not how you expect Chris Pine. And Chris, as a director, is magnificent. He is thorough. He is careful. Needless to say, he is an actor's director, especially, you know, I have scenes with Chris in which he's directing and acting with me. And he's able to switch those hats immediately, be 100% in the scene, then look at me, said, let me take a look at what we've got. And he would take a look at the playback. Then he'd come back with some notes for me, whatever. Or he'd say, do you want to try something else? And the great thing about working with Chris, being an actor's director, is that he's always okay with doing another take, because actors are very insecure. But I just loved it. It was a ton of fun. And working with the people, it's a great cast. Mm. And so if you, you know, gosh, just everybody in the show is so funny. And the whole thing makes no sense at all, but it makes sense in a way. And I think there are a lot of people that are going to enjoy it.
Well, keeping with the idea of a midnight showing and stuff, what's the greeting for people in the audience when your character shows up? You know, they throw a piece of toast.
The thing is, I play really kind of two parts. So I think for the first part, they can throw their yarmulkes into the air. I play a rabbi who's head of the Los Angeles City Council. And so I am one of Chris's chief antagonists, because he's always coming to the city council wanting to make the city better with all of these plans. And he always does these absolutely ridiculous presentations in front of the council. I think he says in the movie he's been in front of the council like over 800 times. And so we're like, okay, here he is again. And he's a almost quasi-street person. I guess I should explain the baseline of the movie so people understand the world of the movie. It isn't that it's science fiction, but it's not really in the world we live in now. It's not really in the present. It takes place in a Los Angeles, in a California, in which there is no more water. Uh-huh. And it's in the middle of a drought, and they're science fiction-wise, there's signs everywhere about, you know, don't let the faucet drip, you know, no water allowed. Big warning signs about we're running out of precious fluid. And Chris plays a pool man in this world, a pool man in Los Angeles where no one has water to have a swimming pool. So that's the kind of wackiness. And he has all the pool equipment, but he never is able to do anything except go to the city council and try to improve the bus system of Los Angeles. I play that part. So for there, I think tossing a yarmulke into the air and that would be safe. And then my other part is kind of a surprise in the movie, and I'll keep it a surprise. but in that I am not who I appear to be at all, or who you would expect me to be. And I think when that appears on film, when that appears on screen, I don't know what would be appropriate. I really don't. I'm not really sure. But I will tell you this, that it took me almost 3 hours to get into costume and makeup for my other role. And it took me over 2 hours to get out of makeup.
Wow.
And they got a specialist down from Northern California to be able to create this other character. And apparently he's famous for this. And so it's really remarkable. If I were to go to the big idea of Pool Man, is do we live in a nonfiction world or a fictional world? Do we live in a world where with our imagination we could be whatever we want to be? Or do we live in a world where we are constrained by economics and location to be what we have, like a world with no water? Can we still be a pool man? You know, are we constrained by what we are? And of course, I think in reality, the answer is both, at least. As an actor in Texas, I knew I had to come to California or New York. And you don't know how many people I've met in Maine, in Florida, when I talk at schools or universities or do things, and they all want to be actors and they all want to be in the business. And I say, first of all, move to California, move to Los Angeles or New York City. And they go, what? I said, well, in Sarasota, there isn't going to be a lot happening. I mean, they may have Granny's Dinner Theater or something there, but you need to have many outlets to try to become an actor, because there's so few jobs in being an actor. So you have to go where there's lots and lots of jobs, and that's either L.A. or New York. Even Chicago, even San Francisco, they don't really have the quantity of jobs availabilities that you would need if you are a young person who wants to be an actor. Simple things like that.
And so, I would assume in those two spots, you're talking about more of a variety. So you can do stage, you can do film, you can do TV, you can do whatever. So you have a lot more options.
Absolutely. And even simple things like if they're doing trade shows, if they're doing commercials, they're probably going to be doing more national or trade show or commercials in these big centers. So that's a simple thing people could do if they want to become actors. And a la Pool Man, you can be an actor in Maine. You know, you can do it. You can do it. There's good theater there. And maybe once in a while, they'll shoot a film there and they will hire people who live in Maine to be in that film. But the odds are against it. And you need somehow to put odds on your side if you're doing a weird profession like being an actor.
We're talking with Stephen Tobolowsky here on Downtown. Speaking of stage work, you're in the midst of some stage work. Tell us a little bit about the Romeo and Juliet Senior Citizens Project.
This is something that has been evolving over the last 2 years. And it's an absolutely wonderful play by Jamie Brandley. She won the Humitas Award out here in Los Angeles for her playwriting. She's absolutely wonderful. And to give you just the absolute science fiction version of what happens in my life all the time. So Jamie Brandley has this style of writing where it is both hilariously funny and then she could break your heart in a second. And it's absolutely moving and profound. And when Annie, my wife, Anne, directed one of Jamie's first plays at the theater that we're doing the Romeo and Juliet project now. And it was a Christmas show called Through the Eye of the Needle. And it was like, I'm going like, the audience is either laughing hysterically and then they're just in tears. And I'm going like, so I asked Jamie at dinner, I said, how do you do this? How do you do this at all? And she said, well, I don't know if you know this playwright. There's a playwright who wrote Crimes of the Heart. Her name is Beth Henley. And she is able to create these plays in which they're hilariously funny. And then my wife, Ann, nudges Jamie and says, Jamie, Stephen knows Beth. It's okay. He knows who she is. And for the people who aren't listening, Beth and I lived together for 16 years. In fact, Beth wrote Crimes of the Heart in our living room. Of course, the play was called Old Granddaddy's Dying at the time, or The Three Mississippi Sisters. And it was a bunch of paper like a foot high. And she's typing and typing on an electric typewriter. And I go, baby, what you got going there? She says, well, I'm writing this play, Old Granddaddy's Dying. And I'm you know, not, I'm thinking, not a great title. Yeah, and she said, well, will you read it? So I'm going like, okay, it's part of the responsibility of being in a relationship that you have to read the other person's novel-like play. And so I start reading this play, and this play is not only good, I'm thinking like, wow, this could be the best play I've ever read in my life. And so I finish it just as she's typing the last page. I'm near the last page, and she pulls the page out of the typewriter and hands it to me. I go, Beth, this play is stratospheric. This play will be famous. This play will be on Broadway, but you can't call it Old Granddaddy's Dying. It needs a better title. And she says, well, what title should it be? And I said, well, the youngest character, the three sisters there, Babe, the youngest character, shoots her husband because she doesn't like the way he looks. So in trial court, I think they would call that a crime of passion. Why don't you call it Crimes of Passion? So that's what she called the play, Crimes of Passion. And we were going to do a little local production of Crimes of Passion. And one of the people in our cast actually had an agent. And so she gave her copy of Crimes of Passion to her agent, who gave it to his friend when he came to visit Los Angeles. And the friend lived in New York. And we get a phone call from Kennedy Airport from somebody named Gilbert Parker wanting to talk to Beth Henley. And I go, Beth, this man wants to talk to you. And she's on the phone looking, and her eyes are like going crazy. And it was Gilbert Parker, the head of the literary theatrical head of William Morris Agency in New York. He wanted to sign Beth, but you couldn't use the title Crimes of Passion because Ken Russell was doing a movie in England right. called Crimes of Passion. And so Beth turned to me and said, well, what can we call it now? And I said, well, why don't you call it Crimes of the Heart? Because that's the same thing as Crimes of Passion, which you guys just did, what, last year?
Yeah, last fall here at Penobscot Theater in Bangor. Absolutely.
So Crimes of Passion. So Jamie Brantley, getting back on the subject. I get off the subject a lot, Rich. Maybe it's a function of my age.
No. That's what we love about you, Stephen.
So Jamie Brantley learned what she learned about playwriting, Romeo and Juliet, from Beth Henley. And we see the legacy going on. So in this, you have a character that is fresh out of drama school. And he comes in, his first job is he wants to do a production of Romeo and Juliet at this old folks' home. That's the only job he could get out of drama school. So I'm just telling you guys, it's a rough. So he comes in to do Romeo and Juliet, and everybody, of course, is old, and most of the people are women, because as we know, us men tend to die before women do. So you have all these old women, you have me there, so I'm going to play Romeo, and my girlfriend, who played a whore on Law and Order, in the play, she's played several whores on several shows on TV. And so that's kind of the role she's gotten. she's my girlfriend at the senior, she wants to play Juliet. And one of the people is a famous actress from Finland who's going to take over a lot of the production, is going to say, no, no, she's not innocent enough. We have a new resident here at the old folks' home who's going to play Juliet. She's the picture of innocence. And so there's a fight as to who's going to play Juliet. And they bring the woman in to audition for Juliet. And she does the famous speech of Juliet's, and when he shall die, I shall take him and cut him into little stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun. And it turns out that the girl they brought in was the woman I, in the play, was in love with when I was 18 years old. And we were in love together, and then I get sent to Vietnam. And we are exchanging letters, and then I'm in Da Nang, and I send her a letter. Will you marry me? And I hear nothing back. And so I have not seen her since then. And I come back, and now I'm in my 70s, which I am, and I've had three marriages and tons of girlfriends, and now I see the woman who's the love of my life, who is there to read for Juliet, and she's going to play Juliet to my Romeo. And we finally have a meeting during a rehearsal. Why didn't you answer my letter? And she goes, what letter? I go, the letter I sent you from Da Nang, Vietnam, asking you to marry me. She never got the letter. So just like in the play, Romeo and Juliet, where they don't get the letter and it leads to their suicide.
Wow.
I did. So my life went one way, her life went another. And so we really enact the play Romeo and Juliet while playing the play Romeo and Juliet. And it is about us getting together as love completion, and will love survive this time?
That
it's
sounds
terrific.
Wonderful. Wow. Yeah.
It's wonderful, and it's hilarious, and it breaks your heart. And it's terrific. So we are mounting a little backer audition kind of production that we're going to be doing next week. So right after I finish the interview today, we're going to have another rehearsal where I get to do all of my Juliet scenes.
Ooh.
Oh, gosh. So sweet. So sweet.
Well, before we let you go so you can get to rehearsal, you've got a story about a play of yours, Two Idiots in Hollywood, right?
Ladies and gentlemen. Sometimes when you live long enough, a story becomes mythological. So I wrote this play when Beth and I were breaking up, and my heart was absolutely broken. And I thought, well, I'm going to sit down and write a play. I didn't know how to really write a play. So I start writing Two Idiots in Hollywood. I write Act One in one day. Then in the next 4 days, I write Act Two. Then an opportunity comes up, a theater opens. Do you have any play to put on in this theater? I go, well, actually, I do have this play, Two Idiots in Hollywood. So we get all of our friends to do Two Idiots in Hollywood. We do it in this theater. We get surprisingly good reviews, except for Variety. Variety said, Two Idiots in Hollywood, a play so horrible that it is beneath the dignity of seven-year-olds. So people were trying to break the news to me, and I said, I tell you what, let's print that up on a banner. Variety, quote, beneath the dignity of seven-year-olds, and put it on the front of the theater, which we did. We sold out for 4 months. During the four months, a producer came to see the show and said, can we turn Two Idiots in Hollywood into a movie? So there I am with my broken heart, Beth and I breaking up. I wrote Two Idiots in Hollywood in 5 days. Now I have a producer. They're going to pay me $70,000 for the script and for me to direct the movie Two Idiots in Hollywood. So we direct this movie, and I direct it with the same people that were in the play. And they all got SAG jobs for being in the play, and they were all happy. And nobody saw the movie. It was never really released. It ended up on Laserdisc. However, it became a cult hit in England, Two Idiots in Hollywood, because for some reason in England, they loved it. And this week, one of the actors who was in Two Idiots in Hollywood is now teaching drama. He's occasionally acting, but mainly he's teaching students. The students there, their favorite movie was Two Idiots in Hollywood, the movie. And yet they could not believe that they were being taught by one of the original people that was in Two Idiots in Hollywood. So he called me 2 days ago and said that the people in his class want to mount the play Two Idiots in Hollywood once again. So I went into my cabinet that you see right behind me. I said, I have no idea where it is. Oh my God, that's the original script. I pulled it out, and now this morning I handed off the stage play, the original stage play of Two Idiots in Hollywood. So the message is this: when you are in despair, like I was, the answer doesn't have to be a complete answer, because in the fullness of time, life can play these enormous jokes on you. And this thing, Two Idiots in Hollywood, which was beneath the dignity of seven-year-olds, was a hit on stage in Los Angeles, ended up being a movie, ended up being my first job that I was able to give myself when I was at the very bottom of my life. And now it's come back around as a play once again. It is, life has a way of taking, and life has a way of giving back. So if you find yourself in that hole, there's got to be a Two Idiots in Hollywood in your life.
Oh, great story. That's a Tobolowsky Files episode right there. That's wonderful.
That could be it. It just, do not despair. There's always something coming around the corner that'll make you smile.
Well, I can't wait to see Pullman once it gets here. Yep. Break Legs with Romeo and Juliet, Senior Citizens Project. By the way, if whoever's playing Montague goes down, I did that part. Yeah, let's see. Many a morning have they there been seen with tears augmenting the fresh morning's dew, adding to clouds more clouds with his deep sighs. But also soon as the all-cheering sun should in the east begin to draw the shady curtains from Aurora's bed, away from light steals home my heavy son. Private in his chamber pens himself, shuts up his windows, locks fair daylight out. All right, I'm ready.
Oh, my God. Maine, say goodbye to Rich Kimball. We are going to pay. Well, it won't be first-class airfare, but I promise you, we will get you the best bus ticket we can get to get you out here to Los Angeles.
Finally, the big time beckons. Finally.
Big time. Big time.
Stephen, thank you so much. As always, great talking with you, and we look forward to hearing more about your adventures the next time we visit.
Yes, sir. You bet, Rich. My pleasure, and I'll send you those pictures.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Bye, Stephen.
Adios. See you, Carrie.
See you, Stephen.
Adios, guys.
Bye-bye.